Today's program has been brought to you by Calavita. Think outside the bottle with Calavita, America's trusted family brand, makers of extra virgin olive oil and fine Italian food products. Calavita.com.
I'm Damon Bolte, host of The Speakeasy. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Food Talk here. It's winding down. This is the last show before Halloween. Happy Halloween, everybody. Hopefully it doesn't rain. It's a great day. Kids and candy. What can go wrong with that? We got a busy show today, so I'm not going to give you my usual rant. Although, I have to say this. Go Mets. Come on, Mets. Come on, Mets. Last night sucked.
Yeah.
It sucked.
My husband out there, he's a diehard. I should show you his Mr. Met tattoo.
And, man.
I just keep, I'm a Yankee fan, but I'm supporting him because I'm a good wife, and he got my kids. And my kids are with Memphis.
The voice of Allison Robicelli.
Yeah, hey, everyone.
Well, I just like to make margaritas in Mets colors. That's kind of how I deal with it. And I can drink them either way.
That's Barbara Sibley, my two guests, and we're going to have Rebecca Charles in here at some point, I think. She is here somewhere. But yeah, the Mets, man. The first game was brutal, too. The power one. I mean, can you imagine? It was like nuts. I couldn't believe it. It was like you're watching. I don't know if you watched it, but it was like live national. It's the World Series. And the power goes out for like 20 minutes. They were like
power
in an infomercial.
And then it went to like 2 a.m.
Only a New York team.
Yeah.
And my kids are 7 and 8. And I was like, all right, we're going to be the cool parents. And we're going to let you stay up. And I passed out at like 9:30. And apparently they stayed up and they passed out on the couch and we were all late to school the next day. And I go in
after
and there are like 60 kids on the I'm late still. And I'm like, yeah, we were all watching the game last night. They're like, just go upstairs. It's just like, you know.
Yeah, 1:15. It was nuts. But you guys are here. So we'll just segue straight into the show because we have three different segments today. We're going to do this one with you guys. And hopefully Rebecca comes back and finds us. If not, we'll do it without her. And then we've got some really good guests coming in. Again, more women chefs coming in. We have this great book that just came out, Women Chefs of New York City. She's going to be in. And then I've got the Cider Week we're going to talk about. So three segments today, but let's start with, there's an event that takes place. Is it the same like weekend in September every year? Do you guys know that?
Yeah, usually it's like around the 20th of September.
Towards the end of September.
A great Monday in end of September.
On the Chelsea Piers.
Yeah.
Called Share, S-H-A-R-E. Yeah.
Right.
The 12th year was this year. And I remember being invited and going to them. I was out of the country, and the show wasn't live yet on Heritage this time. But when I was at WOR, I remember going to them and kind of covering them. And just describe to me what it is, because it's the 12th year. It's a fundraiser for a couple of types of cancer.
Right. Well, there's this great organization called Share, and it's cancer support. So it's the fundraiser called The Second Helping of Life. And Share is a great organization. They give cancer support to women who have breast and ovarian cancer, as well as to their families and caregivers. And they do it also in many languages, like 12 different languages. So it's really an amazing organization. So this fundraiser is all women chefs, and we have such a great time.
And you get these kind of rock star sous chefs.
Right.
So it's women, and the list is super. I mean, this year it was 28. Chefs. Every year it seems to get bigger. I mean, the women chef community keeps growing, and you and I could talk about that too, at some point during the show. But
yeah, sure.
I mean, everybody, Alex Cornicelli was there, Anita Lowe, Sue Torres, the list is too long to go on, Amanda Cohen, Leah Cohen, Sarah Jenkins, so many people.
Rebecca Charles.
And Rebecca Charles, who is here. So it's this great event. And then there's like newscasters and radio personalities as your sous chefs, right?
Is that how it goes? Sous chefs.
It was amazing. Like, this was my second year.
And you had who?
Mine didn't show up this year, but last year I had Joanna Pruess.
She's great. She's a food writer, lives up in the Bronx.
Yeah, they called me kind of 11th hour last year, and it was funny. Like, I'm good friends with Amanda Cohen, and they brought me in, and Rebecca and Deb, who organized, they didn't realize that I'm a cancer survivor. So it was so incredible for me to be able to help. But then, as a lady chef, I was so starstruck. You know, I'm just walking around like, I'm like, oh my God, Sunita Lowe. And like April Bloomfield was there last year.
Yeah.
And these are just the most amazing women like on the planet. And I'm like, how am I here? Like how am I here? I'm just geeking out. And I don't think of an event that I do where the food is better, where the people are nicer, where people care as much. It's really my favorite event that I do all year. And I mean, we raised like how much money did we raise this year?
We raised a little over $500,000, which is a record for us.
It was the same last year. We raised like well over $500,000.
And all of the money goes back into the charity.
All the money goes to Cher.
Yeah, because there was this kind of kerfuffle on Facebook the other day with it. Actually, we started on Eater. We got wrote a piece about the New York Food and Wine Festival and how it's theoretically that money goes to some things and how what a small percentage of that money actually makes it to whatever the charity is supposed to be.
I will not be commenting on that.
I got a lot of shit for it, but I totally agree. I mean, I've been boycotting the food and wine. It's like just kind of because, and I hate to say this, but you know, Southern, if you're in the spirits business in New York City and you're running a restaurant, you sort of Southern, you can't avoid them in a way, but nobody likes them. They're like the Cisco of beverage worlds.
Yeah. I have a big mouth that gets me in trouble a lot, so I'm walking away from this one.
Good for you. Well, the transparency thing is what drives me nuts. If you're saying you're doing something for charity and it turns out that like 15 cents on the dollar actually made to the charity and you're actually profiting, everyone that's getting involved is making money off of this shit show.
I'm just going to put that out
there. No, the chefs get nothing. The chefs fly out for free. I had friends of mine that came in from out of state who fly in, bring their cooks, pay for everything.
We pay for all our own stuff. Yep. We pay for all our own transportation. And that's the thing, Lizzie. People are profiting off of our work, and not just our work, but the actual food. We're paying for it. Yeah. And if you're an event company, you're not doing it for free.
Yeah.
So when you break it down, like you know that the rental companies and the event venues, nobody's donating that. But we still donate that. So
you get to the point after you've done these things for years, like I have and like Barbara probably has. I mean, my restaurant's been around for almost 19 years. And I used to do every event that came down the pike, you know, because you want it's great exposure for the restaurant. You want to help these causes. So, and if your restaurant's doing well, you know, you're giving it away. You're paying your staff, but nobody's, you know, reimbursing you. But the fact is, some of these events are so expensive to produce that that's where the money is going.
Mm-hmm.
So something like this, which is a smaller event.
Which is why we're here today.
Yep. Might seem like a lot, but the really big charities raise $3 to $5 million in a night.
Mm-hmm.
And those things are held at the Waldorf, at the Pierre. They're big ticket events, and they're incredibly expensive to produce. The Cher event at the Chelsea Piers is a modest affair compared to some of these things.
Mm-hmm.
So everything goes to Cher. And a lot, I mean, this is their big moneymaker. They have smaller things that go on throughout the year, but this provides most of their operating budget.
Now, is there a way, we're covering this event sort of posthumously. It happened September 28th, I think, was this year. Again, the show wasn't live till the second week of October, and I was actually out of the country the week you were doing this. But is there a way people go to a website and just donate now or buy tickets for next year? How does that work? Because we're kind of giving a shout out for something that happened 3 weeks ago. Anybody have that answer?
You can donate just by going to the website.
Which is share.org? Does anybody know that?
What the hell is it? Share Cancer?
I don't know. We'll find that out. We know what
it's
going to be.
Since it is posthumously.
It's Share Benefit. Here, I have it right here. It's sharebenefit.org. And there's a phone number.
Well, that's for tickets.
That's for tickets?
So,
But if you go to sharecancersupport.org.
Yeah, that's what you need to go to.
Thank you.
You can donate at any time during the year.
And to piggyback on what we were just saying before with chefs having problems with certain charity events, nobody has a problem doing Cher.
Yeah.
You know, I've had to set a budget during the year because there are so many food events, and it's not even just charities, but there's just so many events, and you can't be everywhere, and you can't be funding everything. And out of my budget, I always line item now Cher.
Done.
I know, regardless of when it's going to be planned or who's doing it, I will put that in because every cent that I put in there is absolutely worth it, and I know where it's going, and I know the good it's doing.
Yeah, and it's something. I mean, there really is this great sort of consolidation of talent and effort, and the cause is just so great. And it's you guys get to party a little bit afterwards because you've got so many.
Tired.
I'm so tired.
Everyone's dead.
I'm so tired.
Last year they were like,
we used to try.
And, you know, it always wind up being like me and Anita and like
it's
Alex.
A school night.
And we go to El Quinto Vino and like have a couple of drinks and drop dead.
I think we're this year. We're getting it together. Right?
In theory,
we always hope to because most of us are so excited to see each other, but we're working.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we have a few seconds to talk while they're taking this big, stupid, like, class picture. And then, you know, we say goodbye and that's it. We don't see each other until next year.
Yeah.
So we always make plans to try to get together. It never, ever works
this
out.
This year I came early. Everybody's busy. You come early because you're like, oh, I get to see my friends at this event. And then you get to hang out and then you get to make new friends.
It's an incredible sight to see every successful chef,
correct,
woman chef in New York,
28 this year, room. It's amazing, the energy is amazing,
and we've been doing this for years. Yeah. And it's just been this under the radar kind of thing. They don't get nearly enough press or promotion.
It's so amazing for me as a chef too, the environment that I feel like I'm in. Like, I'm trying to keep my language somewhat PG-13, but at these other food events, it's like, you know, it can be very macho, it could be somewhat like competitive, and I think that's just New York in general, you know. And when I went to share, you know, all these women, we're all rooting for each other and we all respect each other. And we're so like, you know, it's not judgy or catty. I mean, you love seeing each other succeed and you're interested in each other's projects and you're inspired by your peers. And it makes you feel better as a chef. And
it's a very different environment than most of these.
Yeah,
tasting events.
I mean, I get genuinely excited when I see people I've barely met. Like, I was right behind Roxanne, who is opening up Kingsley.
First
time I've met her, and just talking to her, talking about her new project and her energy. We spent like 2 hours together.
I talked to her too.
Yeah,
like, we corralled a lot of new people this year.
Yeah.
Because, you know, some of these women that have been doing it for years get tired of doing it.
But, yeah, after 2 hours, I'm not talking about her restaurant to everybody I know, you know? And it's that. It's a community. It's women who really want, you know, all of us to succeed together. And, you know, that's just the spirit of it.
And we're doing it for something that's...
Wanting women to succeed together.
Yeah. I mean...
women have to help other women.
Something that affects everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Rich, poor, middle class, every ethnicity... Everybody knows somebody who has cancer or has it themselves. You know, we honored a pastry chef that we love very much who's very ill now with it that night.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So what's so amazing about this group is it started as a hotline and it's grown to be this very efficient outreach where they go into communities now. They go to consulates to try to deal with, you know, African women. They go to... churches and local organizations to try to get into the community to provide information and continual support for people that are going through this that have no resources whatsoever.
When I was diagnosed with cancer, I was 21, so thank God. I mean, I had my mom. But you're immediately just thrust into something. Like, first off, they're telling you, like, hey, you might die, you know, which is enough to take in. And then all of a sudden, they're like, here's all the tests you have to go through. These are all the insurance companies you have to go. This is all the fighting you're going to have to do with the insurance company to get, you know, the drugs you need or the care you need. You know, you need a support network. You need to find out how you're going to get to and from chemo. Like, it's... So many things on a to-do list.
That none of us
where are you going to work?
None of us ever think about.
Unless you've had family members.
Yeah.
I mean,
how,
that's,
right.
I think that's, I lost a brother to leukemia, but isn't it until you have that interface? I mean, you hear about it, but it's an abstract kind of third-person thing.
And I think that's also why, you know, as a support system, it's so strong, because it's so strong in terms of people who have gone through cancer, mm-hmm. who give the support, and then also to the caregiver. So it's really, really like, you know, I think when you've gone through it, you know, there's sort of a shorthand that you know exactly what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. And it's an organization that's able to bring that shared experience together in a really remarkable way. And they especially a lot of, like you're saying, like, these really underserved communities, African-American communities, Latino communities in the city that really, really don't have any advocates as well. And so it's incredibly powerful.
Being in a position where immediately you just feel so lost, you know, and you have to worry about income, work, insurance, health, everything. And just have somebody out there reaching out to say, hey, listen, we got you. You know, just don't be scared. We got you. We're going to get through this.
You know, it's one thing to get a diagnosis and die. It's another thing to get a diagnosis and attempt to survive.
Mm-hmm.
And just things like transportation to and from chemo, how to deal with chemo session after session after session.
Little things.
You know,
no one thinks of little things.
A lot of people live with cancer for years.
Little quality of life things like mouth dryness or losing your hair or, you know, finding a decent wig, finding clothes that you're comfortable in, you know, like self-care. I mean, God, when I got sick, I was put on these steroids. My whole face blew up. Like, I gained 30 pounds within 2 weeks. And, you know, suddenly you're like, I'm bald and I'm fat and I'm in sweatpants all the time. I was 21 years old. I mean, I don't want to look like an egg in sweatpants. So just people tell, you know, like, you know, taking you out, keeping you company, you know, giving you a pedicure, making you feel human. Because so many people, when you are sick, people look at you like that girl that has cancer. They just see the cancer. But you're still under there. So to have people look at you and see you, not your illness, but see you, I can't tell you how important that is. And support and people looking at you like human instead of a disease.
There have been a few years when I said, you know, I've done this every single year.
Yeah, since year one.
Well over a decade.
Okay.
I got it. Enough. I got to, you know, move on. I can't do this anymore. It's a ton of food we're giving away. It's a ton of money. And we're very involved with planning the event as well. So my partner, Deb, and I. So, you know, leading up to the event, sometimes we think, oh, God, are we really going to go through this again? It's so stressful to plan it. And then I think about what they do, and I realize I'm never going to be able to get out of this, ever.
Because and they do it for free, too, much these volunteers.
Because this organization really does what you hope a charity organization is going to do.
Great, guys.
And we have a cookbook coming out, don't we, next year?
We're going to do a cookbook next year.
Seriously.
We've already started planning it. And that's going to be a great book. Great photography.
Best, Angie Morrison, Alex Warner Shelley, April Bugge,
even the people that haven't been there in a couple of years, Gabriella Hamilton, you know, April, they're all going to provide recipes. And
Sarah Beth. Oh, she's a legend. And she's there and she's working. She's whipping cream by hand. It's unbelievable.
At the event, really, it's not like a lot of events where people like say, you know, they come in and they go and they have one cocktail and then the chefs just leave like their staff. I mean, we're really there.
No, we're
there. And we love to be there. We have a great time.
It's just idol after idol. Just so many people
it's
I look up to
and
respect.
And now the new guard. Coming in.
If you're a female chef, I'd go. Like, just if you're any kind of chef or any kind of cook, I mean, this is the event you'd go to. Not like, you know, not the glitzy network branded ones. This is it. This is all the talent and all the good in one.
And we're also like including now in the cocktail world, which is great.
Oh, yeah.
Like the Julie Reiners, like, you know, some really really fabulous.
Now,
yeah, with Lupek and stuff. So it's great. Great to. Yeah. To, you know, the community is larger and better, and it's and hopefully we'll raise even more money for them.
I'll have to talk to somebody at Heritage, Erin, one of my bosses, and see if we can't get you guys in next year. Not on my show, but in September, a couple of weeks in advance, to do the same thing again.
We'll just show up.
Just show up and grab the microphone. Yeah. All right, you hear that,
I'm
Liz?
Good like that.
They're just going to come in and grab the microphone.
we'll call
the share hour.
We did a show last year before the event
here
with Julia Tertian.
Okay.
And Kathleen Chalfont, who's one of the celebrity sous chefs. Originally, this event was set up to be celebrity sous chefs with women chefs.
Right.
And I think over the years, the women chefs tended to overshadow the actual celebrities, like the theater celebrities that they were getting in, because cooking has become such entertainment.
But as a New Yorker, they're like the best celebrities. Like, I was next to Valerie Smaldone, who was like on Light FM. And, you know, when you're a New Yorker, like Sade Bervenois and like Valerie Smaldone are everything. You know, they're New York celebrities. I'm not impressed by, like, I saw Matthew Broderick on the street. I thought he looked sad and he needed a hug. I don't care about him. But, like, Valerie Smaldone!
Don't say that. He was in my restaurant a week ago and he's adorable.
And if he had been at the Share event, he would have been much happier.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
But there are wonderful, real theater people there, and a lot of newscasters from New York. Ruth Reichel's been there many years.
Daphne Ribavega.
It's great. I will be there next year, unless, again, I said I was out of the country this year. So
it's okay. We forgive you.
Next year. So thanks, guys, for coming in, and thanks for doing the event, and I will see you next year on the Chelsea Piers, whenever it is, one of those last Mondays in the...
September. It's like September 20-something-something.
Yeah. So, Rebecca Charles, Alison Robicelli, thanks so much. Barbara Sibley, great to talk. We got to get you another time and talk about sort of the year-long view of the New York kitchen scene, which is great, because you were really one of the pioneers in here. Thanks, guys. And again, go to the Share website. Any donation would be great. They'd love to see you. And then next year, you can't miss this. It really is like a love fest for all the women talent in New York City, and all the money goes to a cause, which is kind of what we like to say. Thanks, guys, for coming in.
Thank you.
Nice to see you.
Get back to work. We're going to shuffle the deck here. Thank you.
This is the story of men and women who shed not only their clothes, but also their...
Folks, Mike Colomeco here. Everybody knows that great cooking really starts with great ingredients, and these days we have so many options to choose from. Well, I go back to the Cola Vida family brand for years, and there really is a Cola Vida family behind this brand. I got their story long after I started using their products. Back in the mid-80s, when I was the chef at the Ritz-Carlton here in New York City, one of the things you can do as a chef is order your own food. You do the purchasing, and we switched olive oils to Cola Vida. When I had my own restaurant down in Cape May, New Jersey, the Globe, for years, that's all we ever poured at the table. That's all I ever cooked with. And then when I started my PBS show in 1999, I thought, you know, if I'm going to look after underwriting and funders, why don't I go after products that I actually use at home, that I actually cook for my family with and in my restaurant with. I've been working with them for 15 years with the PBS series and now with Heritage Radio. The Cola Vida family goes back generations in Italy. They make their olive oil from great sourced olives, traceable sourced olives, just south of Rome in Molise province, Abruzzo, which is where my family hails from. Since then, their family's moved here, so they're Cola Vida's living in Rome. Cola Vida's living in America. It's a great, trusted family brand. It's the olive oil I use, and I recommend you try it as well. Okay, everybody, hey, we're back with the second segment of a three-segment show. So kind of hectic in here today. Sorry, but I booked it, so I can just yell at me. There's a big week coming up, November 6th to November 15th. Cider Week in New York, and it's pretty epic, and it's grown. Does anybody know how many? Is this like the second, third, fifth Cider Week?
It is the fifth Cider Week.
The fifth, okay, okay. Because I know that Jimmy Carbone's been doing stuff, and it just keeps expanding. So I've got three guests in the studio. Patty Jackson, who is the chef proprietor of Delaware and Hudson. Congratulations, by the way, on getting through. I mean, I'm a big fan of your cooking. You've been in kitchens for a long time in New York doing great, great, great work. You were in Manhattan on my side of the bridge for the longest time, and now you've crossed over to Williamsburg. That initial review wasn't the best thing I've ever read. I don't know what's going on. But then Wells. But then he had you in the best.
He gave us
but at the end of the year, like a couple of months later, it was like the 10 best things he'd had this year. You were in that or something.
Yeah.
Like the yearly recap. So
he's been pretty generous with us, actually.
Good. Because there was a disconnect. And I know that those, you know, the Times sends... Time pushes volume.
You know, Mike, I don't know if I think of it as a disconnect. I mean, he gave us a one-star review, but with a critic's choice even at the beginning. So... You know, it's kind of a casual space, and it's out in Williamsburg. And
whatever, but you're doing great. Year and a half in, 2 years in,
you're having a blast.
It. Super, super. And you guys opened up together this bar. Talk about it.
Wassail is the name of the bar. It's a restaurant and bar in the Lower East Side in Manhattan. We focus on ciders. We have about 100-plus bottles of ciders, 12 ciders on draft, cider cocktails, and many other cocktails as well.
What street? Give me the address.
Orchard Street.
Between?
Stanton and Rivington.
my neighborhood. So you're down there with...
No reaction? Orchard Street or Cider Bar. Come on.
Oh,
what better place?
Oh, no. Yeah. See, it's so funny. I've been living near... Okay, that's great, though. Great neighborhood. Super, super neighborhood for restaurants. I mean, Russ and Daughters is down there now. Shuts gates up the street from you. King's got Kuma in around the corner. There's just so much going on. So it's funny. Cider. So when... Cider is this... Like, you go back historically in America, like colonial, pre-colonial, and it was like water. Drinking water wasn't safe in America. Cider was what people drank. Like, everybody drank cider in this country for the longest time, and then hard cider was kind of this accident, as the cider was, so they say, stored outside, and it froze, and it became more concentrated. Talk to me about what drew you guys into cider.
Well, we have very different stories that wound up converging. My wife and I opened up a restaurant in Queens called the Queens Kickshaw, and the idea never really involved cider, except that we did have cider on our list initially. But we got involved with the first Cider Week and got inspired by an event that our partner in the future restaurant, Wasail, Sabine, put on up at Glenwood. And this was an event that brought in cider makers from Hudson Valley and also from La Perche in Normandy, which is a traditional cider growing region, and there are quite a few in Europe, so it doesn't have the truncated history in other parts of the world that it does in the U.S. And it was there that we really got inspired by the vastly different qualities that you could find in different ciders from different regions, and where we met cider makers and really decided at that point that we wanted to grow our cider list at the Queen's Kickshaw, which is what we did over the next several years, growing from about 3 in the beginning to up to 35, and then 2 cider taps, cider cocktails by the glass, etc. We saw our sales of cider jump from about 5% of our overall alcohol sales to up to 30% in the last year. So it's, you know, we've seen the way that the excitement for cider has grown. The industry has grown, the, you know, interest as well as production, everything has sort of grown quite organically, but very quickly.
And if you think about, because cider in America, I mean, just for people that aren't so familiar with it, I mean, we've kind of, the interest in wine has expanded a lot. Our per capita consumption's up. There's never been a better time to be a wine drinker in America, especially in New York and San Francisco and Chicago. We're getting wines. I mean, I have French friends that come in here that are like, my God, you got wines on these wine lists. I don't even have them in front of. How are you getting these? And a lot of allocations are coming here. There's so many great stores and resources. And cider's kind of riding that wave. And if you think about it, and I kind of had to think about it, you know, you think of grape varietals, you think of terroir, you think of how wine is made and what makes it so interesting. And the exact same is true with apples and cider and naturally occurring yeasts and this whole sort of bio and organic process. So you want to just back it up and talk about sort of Cider 101, how it's made, just so we can kind of get up to speed on that?
Sure. I mean,
it's the easiest thing. It's the easiest thing in the world, and we can see how it happens, but walk us through.
Cider is much more akin to wine than it is beer. That's a common misconception that cider is brewed, which it's not.
Right.
It's fermented just like wine, and all you need is the juice of the apples. And in most cases, there's already naturally occurring yeasts, and it's going to happen. The sugars are going to ferment out, and you're going to get alcohol and CO2, and that's what you get with cider. So there's many different cider making approaches, however, and so one thing that's interesting you had just mentioned about terroir and varietals, these things come into play in cider making for sure. However, there's obviously, you know, it's a different fruit, it's a different there's different qualities that are happening in the fruit, and so therefore in some cases terroir does not play the same kind of role. In some cases the varietal is actually something that needs to be complemented with other varietals. So you could argue the same thing with wine, that you know, wines, you know, single varietal wines are you know, not for everyone.
Right, and then you think of, like, champagne is the art of brewing different vintages, different grape varietals, and Bordeaux has always been. When you drop a canvas over Bordeaux, you've got Cabernet Sauvignon, you've got Cab Franc, you've got Merlot, you've got Petit Verdot, you've got Malbec growing there. Left bank would be more Cab heavy, right bank would be more Merlot, but it's same idea. I mean, these are blends straight up and always have been.
Right, so apples have a either you know, an acidic forward component, or a sweet forward component, or a tannic forward component, or some combination thereof. And there's very few varietals that really work really well on their own as a single varietal, right, because they have that nice balance. But really, you're going to need to blend apples in order to get that, you know, a balanced taste, but also the depth.
Go ahead.
Well, I mean, I think part of it also is the beauty of the apple, right, is that each seed in an apple has its own signature. If you plant the five seeds in an apple side by side, you don't get five identical trees and you don't get five identical apples.
So, and they're genetically quite distinct from their parents, so they call them extreme heterozygotes. So the apple is weird.
Say that again.
But so wild apples, and the apples that they just kind of planted to plant to homestead land originally in America, you know, there wasn't a lot to do with them besides, you know, crush them up, take the juice, and make alcohol out of them. They were like the perfect complement to being, you know, kind of poor and lonely and out on the frontier, because you could just make your own alcohol all you wanted.
And so tell me about, thanks for that great explanation. So now we're sort of boring down on the idea that much like wine, we have varietals that carry with them. And it's just like, I mean, anyone that's listening to the show goes to farmers markets, and we're in the fall season now, and you go to Union Square on Wednesday or whenever you go, and there's a shit ton of apples there, and everyone smells a little different. Everyone has a little bit of different flesh, a little bit different skin quality. Some are sweeter, some are more acidic, some are more perfumey. That same thing is germane to making cider.
Absolutely.
And the yeast that grow on them naturally.
But many cider makers will say that probably the ciders that are the most complex and interesting to drink are those made with cider apples. So these are not apples that you can eat. So that's kind of an important distinction. It's not to say that you can't make a really delicious cider with eating apples, but cider apples are kind of, you know, if you take a bite out of them, they're so tannic, they're so stringent. They call them spitters. They're really only made for fermentation, and they add this kind of level of complexity when they ferment that create a really superior product. But so they take a long time to grow.
That's what's been growing up in Normandy forever. That's what they're going to do. This completely separate crop that was just for that, because that's what I think. Calvados and ciders, like, that's the hallmark.
Well, actually, yeah, Ben's been...
No, that's right. That's absolutely right. I mean, certainly some of those apples are eating apples as well, and there's many eating apples that do go into blends of great cider. But in order to get those, you know, those astringent notes, those really, you know, really tannic sort of, you know, just, you know, scraping the palate kind of notes, you need to have bittersweet apples, and those aren't going to taste very good.
And the ones, the ones in the States were planted, they've been here forever? They've been planted recently? They're heirloom varieties? How's it work? This I don't know.
I mean, there's
all of the above?
All of the above, yes. Okay. There's definitely heirloom varieties that have survived. There's heirloom varieties that have been brought back and resuscitated.
Right.
There's also wild apples, which have accidentally, just like Patty was saying, turned into something great, because each apple tree is going to be unique if it was grown from a seedling.
And then there's oak used... all the time, some of the time? Is this like an oak versus stainless argument like we have in wine?
There seems to be a trend in kind of barrel-aged ciders in America anyway, but I wouldn't say it's a lot of people doing it. You know, most people will make a variety of ciders and have maybe one of them.
Oaked.
Aged in oak, yeah.
Yeah, I think just like the, you know, even in beer, you know, at a certain point people start to try to experiment with different sorts of aging and flavoring, and so that's coming through a fair amount now, but it's not like an extreme amount.
Patty, you've got how many ciders on your menu now? Like in a normal, like I walk in, I grab the wine list,
you
have a cider.
Walk in, we have, I believe right now we have 8 or 9. We usually only have things in large format, so that kind of, you know, a lot of those are limited edition sort of things. So
we'll talk about Cider Week. Tell me about this, because we're kind of... we're on cider, so we're not off topic, but you're here for Cider Week, and we're out in advance of it. So it's taking place at venue every night all over town. There's different events taking place for a week?
Yeah, it was basically begun to develop a market, you know, to raise awareness and demand for the product. So the first Cider Week just reached out to a few restaurants and shops, and it kind of grew from there, from the enthusiasm that we encountered with a lot of the beverage directors and the buyers who had a secret passion for cider but didn't have a way to express it. So once they got a little promotional platform to do it. It was really them, their enthusiasm, their passion for sharing that excitement with their guests that really kind of made it take off. And so it's a bunch, you know, about 100 or more, 150 restaurants, merchants, bars all across New York City. And then they put on their own events. They choose and decide what makes the most sense for them. And then it goes up on the Cider Week calendar. And it's just a big party. The only irony, though, is that for the cider makers, this is about the worst time.
Because they're in peak production? It's like, we're going to have a big wine event during the crush. No. Can you leave for 3 days? No.
So the question is the public ready now to think about cider at another time in the fall? I mean, you know, the makers are nervous because for the public, for the press, it's like you think apples and it's fall. Yeah. But in reality, you really should do it when you're releasing the bottles in the spring. That would be the cool thing to do.
And that is, so that's the typical, that's the release time. So kind of like, it's a real sure, I guess white wines might be that quick a turnaround, depending on if you oak them or if you didn't. But that's the age. So made in the fall, bottle or casked, and then released in the spring.
I mean, not all of them. Some people definitely age, and some new makers are experimenting with aging more. But in general, you want to drink a cider fairly young.
And food pairings. We haven't gotten the food pairings yet. And I would imagine, and you guys run with this, take the lead, but I'm not a cider drinker, so I'm just guessing, but I'm thinking it's got bubbles, it's got acid, it's got tannin, it's got a kind of a minerality. I mean, it's so, cheese would be perfect, fried foods, cured meats. What else do you think? What else are you pairing it with?
We do a fair amount of braised meat. We'll be serving a whole pork roast, a whole roast pork for one event, and then that week we'll have some cider braised pork as well.
So cider's in the recipe the same way you'd be doing a red wine braise and serving it with that wine.
Yeah, we have a couple of different things. We make a thing called shaker rarebit, which is a super old school recipe, but it's almost like a fondue with cider and some strong cheeses. And that's kind of a delicious thing that we really like.
And so, your menu at Wassail?
Yeah, Wassail and Kickshaw are both vegetable-focused restaurants or vegetarian. There's no meat. We don't really advertise that fact, but we find that vegetables and cheese and grains and cooking processes really lend themselves to a wide array of different ciders, because within the world of cider, it's, you know, it's not just crisp, clean, dry, you know, and clean tasting. It's you've also got funky barnyardy, you know, Basque ciders, and you've got, you know, off dry but really, really tannic and farmhousey French ciders, and you've got really, really dry English ciders, and you know, so, and you've got still ciders and you've got sweet ciders, so there's really like a
this world
really
of
wide palette of stuff to choose from.
Why haven't I come to your restaurant yet? Because I'm an idiot. So I'm just thinking, like, dude, like, that's 5 minutes from where I live.
But I think you got the nail on the head in terms of, you know, I mean, for most ciders, you know, you've got the bubbles, you've got, you know, this acidity, and that's going to go great with anything fatty. So definitely cheese, butter, anything cooked in butter. So that could be mushrooms, it could be asparagus, artichoke, you name it. Like, things are going to pair really well.
All right. You've got my interest. Cider Week coming up, New York. The dates are, again, November 6th through the 15th. I'm sure Jimmy Carbone, who's got a show on this network, will talk about it, because I know Jimmy's doing events at Jimmy's 43, at least a couple of events.
He's always been at the forefront. Actually, the first trade tasting for Cider Week got thrown together at his place at the last minute. So he's always been
day one.
Yeah. But one thing we're really excited that we've been planning along with Cider Week and the Lower East Side Bid is a street festival, because there's a street closure on Orchard Street every Sunday.
Yeah, I'm never there.
And so we just decided what a fantastic opportunity to make something happen during Cider Week. So the first Sunday of the weekend, which is November 8th, from 12 to 4 p.m., we're going to kind of be set up all along Orchard Street with cider makers pouring samples and restaurants serving bites and lots of family-friendly activities, a community cider press.
What's the date?
That is Sunday, November 8th,
okay.
With Farnham Hill selling apples that are going to be crushed right on site, so people can take a gallon of like premium cider apple juice to go home and ferment. So lots of fun stuff.
Thank you, guys. Liz, is my next guest in? Thank you. Okay, looks good. Thanks so, so much, guys. Hectic day here. We usually have a little more time to go into things. Sorry. But I booked the show, so I can only blame myself. But congratulations.
We're waiting for you.
Yeah, I know. I've got to come in. It sounds so cool. And
we also have a great wine list. So
my son's totally into wine, and we hang out, and we're just like, you know, he's all become like this total wine geek. And yeah, so we'll see you soon.
You know what? We're down the street from Wildair, so often.
Yeah, I know the guys from Contra.
There's pinging back and forth happening, so you can.
Wildair's great. I love those guys. Thanks so much for coming in. All right, stay tuned. Next guest will be Nadia. We're going to talk about her book, Women Chefs of New York, which is great. So stay tuned for that in just a minute.
Attention. Are you there? Hello, 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 hello. I'm talking to you. Hi. Hey, this is Jack Inslee. I'm the executive producer here at Heritage Radio Network. I've been here at the station since 2009, and I cannot believe just how much this network has grown over that time. We've been able to grow because of donations from people like you. So if you're enjoying this, if you laughed, if you learned something, contribute anything. $1, $2, $10, $100, $1,000, anything counts. And trust me, we'll appreciate seeing your name come through on the donations. So consider visiting heritageradionetwork.org, click on that little beating heart, the donate button, and show us you care. Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoy the rest of the show.
Thank you, thank you, thank you. And indeed, do contribute, do contribute. We need it. We are a good source here. So segment number three of a hectic October show. The week before, the couple days before Halloween, Nadia Arumugam. Say that again. You pronounce it. Your last name.
It's Arumugam.
Arumugam. I tried. I always screw stuff up like this.
It sounds exactly as it's spelled. That's the trick of it.
Which is probably why I screwed it up, because I have been special ed my whole life. So you just wrote this book. Is this your first?
This is my third book, actually.
Okay. See, obviously I've done no homework, but but I've read it. Women Chefs of New York, and it's so... so cool. So tell me, what gave you the idea? Not that you needed an idea to do this, but I'll just jump right in head first. I think one of the things I liked most about the book, and I've been, you know, kind of collect cookbooks, and because I've been doing radio and TV, I'm sent like reams of them every year. Mm-hmm. Most of them I just look at and shake my head and look at recipes that don't work and people that don't know what they're talking about, and they go to the Strand or let them distribute them. And once in a while I get a book and I say, wow, this is really interesting. So what I like, so this book is about, how do I break this down? So it's Women Chefs of New York, which is a great title, a great topic. And it's funny because I was thinking today, I got here in 1982, that's when I came to New York City. And like, you couldn't have written this book really till the last 5 or 10 years, because the Women Chefs of New York in 1982 were like three. That was like such a different world. And the kitchen world was just so different. My wife went to the Culinary Institute. That's where we met. I graduated before her. And when she came out, was a CIA grad, freshly minted. And this was true for everybody in New York. As a woman, CIA grad or Johnson or Wales grad in the 80s, you'd come to a New York kitchen. Mm-hmm. And if they hired you, it would be pastry or garmage. No women were working the hotline. Mm-hmm. It was like, what's the matter? And I don't know. I mean, it could have just been these old European guys just... cultural bias, I don't know. So for so long, women were sort of kept off of the hot side and really had to fight their way in. And just fast forward to today, and it's just such a paradigm shift. Mm-hmm. But you broke this book down, we'll talk about the format, but I think the thing I liked the most about it was with each woman that you're going to cover, and with each of the 8 or 9 recipes that they give, before that there's like a 1 or 2 page kind of preamble about who they are, what got them into the business, kind of a Q&A. That's great. I know about half the women in this book. Mm-hmm. I've had them on this show before, or my other food talk at WOR, or my PBS show, and I'm learning stuff. So talk about where you got that idea, because I just think it's great kind of narrative storytelling rather than just a recipe book.
Right.
You're kind of getting to know who these women are.
And you exactly hit the nail on the head. Let me backtrack a little bit to when I first conceived of the idea, which was back in 2013. And I remember having almost a sort of an aha moment where there really seemed to be a disparity between what I was seeing in the media and on bookshelves and what I was seeing in my neighborhood. Now, I live in the West Village, and there are countless great restaurants helmed by women. I mean, just off the top of my head, I'm thinking April Bloomfield, The Spotted Pig.
Rebecca Charles was just here before you were here today. Yeah, mm-hmm. We can keep going. On
exactly.
And on and on.
You know, Jody Williams.
Jody Williams with Bouvette, which is just off the hook.
Exactly. And then, you know, thinking further, you know, Lower Manhattan General, Gabriel Hamilton, Amanda Cohen. And so it just struck me, you know, there were all these great women chefs. I was eating at their restaurants regularly, but I wasn't seeing these names in magazines, on bookshelves. And I thought, being a writer and always looking for a next book idea or an article idea, I thought, well, this is obviously great material for a next book.
Anita Lowe's around the corner from you with
exactly.
Anissa. So yes, I know all of them.
But I think what I was very careful to do at the outset was I didn't want to go to the chefs with anything that smacked of affirmative action in any way. It wasn't that these chefs needed a leg up. They weren't victims. You know, they didn't need my help. It was more about celebrating great chefs. These were extremely successful businesswomen, entrepreneurs mostly, and they'd made it to the top of their game. And I just wanted to showcase them. I wanted to tell their stories. And that, for me, was a very important part of the book. I don't think I would have done it had it just been a book of recipes. The profiles and the Q&As are really integral to the book. I wanted to reveal the personalities behind the food. You know, I think
that's, to me, that's what's always so much more interesting as a chef.
Exactly.
And the guy who sort of morphed into the media isn't just, okay, here's the recipe and here's the mm-hmm. restaurant and here's a beauty shot of the plates. Okay, but that's just food. What's the
right.
story behind
exactly.
this
and,
person?
And a plate of food isn't just a plate of food.
It's
encapsulates
an yes.
entire history. It you know, it speaks to what they ate as children, what their mothers cooked, their inspirations, their motivations. And you know, and I hope the story is really lend to the recipes and really kind of showcase the recipes and it's sort of like a jigsaw puzzle. Kind of it you sort of piece together these moments of these chefs' lives and you think, okay, now I understand their food.
So you broke it down. So here's the book again. Women Chefs of New York is the book. It just came out. It's published by whom? Who's the publisher, kiddo?
It's Bloomsbury.
Bloomsbury. Okay, big house. There's an introduction, which is great. You have must read. And then it's kind of broken down in sections, American and modern American, with a collection of chefs who all these kind of household names by now. But, of course, Gabrielle Hamilton, who's completely blown up and deservedly so. She's a brilliant kid. Amanda Freitag, Amanda Cohen, April Bloomfield. Mexican, Spanish, Latin flavors. Alex Raj, who we adore. Ivy Stark, who is an absolute beast. She is great. Barbara Sibley, who was here earlier.
I know. I just saw her.
She was here in the day. Asian Fusion. And we're going to get to some of these stories. Leah Cohen, Sohee Kim, Anne Redding, then Mediterranean and Middle Eastern pastry, which is not surprising because so many of the great pastry kitchens of New York are mm-hmm. almost exclusively women at the top and women underneath them.
Right.
Just like little... glowing balls of happiness in otherwise horribly disorganized macho kitchens. Like, you go on the hot side and the guys are all sweaty and tattooed and this kind of testosterone. It's like the football locker room. And then you go to the pastry side and it's like butterflies and rainbows. But I don't know why. I hate to say it's not, I don't mean that to be sexist, but it's like, it's just women happily doing pastry and it's quiet and it's cooler and it's more organized.
It's true, but you know, it's, there's something of a misconception that it is. They're sort of very chilled back and relaxed.
Well, the restaurants are never that.
Because pastry is incredibly labor-intensive. Yeah. And probably why it's so quiet is because they're focusing every iota of mental energy they have on getting it right.
Yeah. I'm like, you don't want to, I don't bake. I there's like three things I can make, and the rest of it's like, you don't want to eat it.
Well, you know, so I tested all these recipes and retested, and I have to say the most challenging part were the dessert recipes.
Yeah.
I mean, Gaia Oliveira's recipes are mind-boggling. And I deliberately left it to the very end.
So tell her story. Tell her story. Let's just jump in there on that.
Right. Well, and that's a great... she's a great chef to start with, because Gaia really has a fascinating story. And I sort of mentioned in my profile that, you know, sometimes life starts out in a completely different direction, and then you get thrown, you get dealt a set of cards...
And then it's
a U-turn, and you're doing something completely different.
Yeah.
You know, she started off in finance, and she found herself in New York because her sister was over here and needed help. She wasn't well, and Gaia arrived and suddenly found her credentials were worth nothing. You know, she had studied hard and long and done it very well. Arrived here and
get in line,
and she was told she couldn't work in finance. She was also a ballerina. Similarly, she went to all these dance studios and told actually, you know what, your training doesn't come for anything over here. And Gaia is very strategic, and she said to herself, look, what industry can I see around me where you can start at the bottom and you can make your way to the top and it doesn't matter where you came from? And the restaurant industry was, you know, the obvious choice. And so she started as a dishwasher. She found herself in the pastry kitchen. By luck, she found herself in Daniel Boulud's empire. She spoke French.
I was about to say, a good kitchen to get lost in.
And she spoke French, which was essential because she was able to communicate with her senior chefs. And she just worked extremely hard. I mean, Guy is one of the most driven people you'll ever meet. And just speaking to her, she speaks with a real intensity and a real kind of focus of mind. But she's very shy. She's wonderful. She's so lovely and sweet. But you can tell that once she gets into the kitchen, she's an animal.
Yeah.
And now she's the executive pastry chef at Daniel.
Which is pretty astonishing. I mean, it's Daniel. Kudos to Daniel Boulud, who has been a mentor for a generation or two of young and not so young chefs now, who have come up through that empire, gone out on their own. And if you could draw a tree of people that have come through Daniel's kitchen and the branches that have come off of it, it would be astonishing. And he's great. Dynex is just great for promoting from within, for nurturing talent, recognizing talent, and finding them a home. She's a great story, and Daniel's just, I think, one of everybody's heroes. We had Sarah Jenkins out here last week or the week before with her mom, because they just did this cookbook. It was so cool. And then I saw her later that night at a dinner we all went to. Who else? I mean, there's some funny... Leah Cohen's a funny one. So here's this this kid who by any means should have never ended up in a kitchen. Her parents are professionals, dentists, Scarsdale, New York, one of those hallowed zip codes where people move for the school system. You know, she probably should have gone on to a really good college and become some kind of professional, or the typical tracking of people that come from these certain zip codes. And yet, no. So talk about Leah, because she cracks me up.
You know, she had a story that I heard several times while talking to the chef. And, you know, there were these, at one point, there were young girls, and they, like everyone, they're finding their passion in life. They're looking for that one thing that excites them. And she was, you know, a little lost. And then, you know, she found cooking. And she went to culinary school, and she realized that that was something she was exceptionally good at. And to much to her parents' delight, it was the one thing that really captured her attention and her focus and her drive, And there she was. She, the success, you know, she, and I think like everything, you really, you have to find it. And sometimes you do and sometimes you don't.
And she's hungry. I mean, she's one of these chefs. I live around a corner from her restaurant, the Pig and Cow, on Clinton Street. And Jen, she's in the kitchen. I mean, she's not, yes. There's like April Bloomfield, like a lot of the chefs in this book. I remember going into the Spotted Pig when you couldn't really get in. I used to live in the West Village, right. Shoe on Abingdon Square. And I would some days I would just go in like 3 p.m, like that only time we could actually get a table and order something simple. And I would, you know, come in to say hi to her, and you know, she's on the line on the hottest station, yeah. On the grill, burn marks up, yeah. Her arm. I mean, she's just a badass.
Absolutely. And you know, just go back to Leah, you know,
and Leah's food's sort of influenced her mom's Filipino.
It is, and it's funny because she said that originally when she conceived of her restaurant, it actually wasn't going to be Filipino food at all. She had taken some time and traveled through Southeast Asia, yep. Spent a lot of time in Thailand. And for her, authenticity is at the center of what she does. She never wants to put food on a plate where she hasn't spent time in that environment and cooked in that environment.
And she travels. I tell you, yes. This still every year, yes. Her and her boyfriends, I think they're fiancés now or whatever.
Yes,
whatever.
She's engaged.
Whatever. But they travel together, one or the two of them. Her parents have a house in the Philippines too, and they'll go to Malaysia, they'll go to Thailand, yep. And they come back with the bon bagage,
yes.
Notebooks, scribbles, pictures, and replicate what they had.
And that's something to be really admired because, yeah. There are a lot of chefs who, you know, read a cookbook and suddenly think that they've mastered that cuisine. And as someone, you know, I'm yeah. Malaysian, yeah. By birth, and you can't just read a book about Malaysian food and suddenly think that you're qualified to cook that cuisine.
Sorry, no, it doesn't work that way. Talk about that restaurant out in Brooklyn, Tanarin, and the owner, because she's a great story. This is sort of an underserved story.
Yes.
She gets almost no press, and the place is lovely. Talk about her. And
so Rabia Bishara, her restaurant Tanarin is out in Bay Ridge, and It's probably the most authentic Palestinian food, yeah. You'll find in New York. And she is a wonderful story. You know, she, like many home cooks, cooked for everyone she knew. She, in the way of demonstrating her affection, her love for friends, her family, was to cook for them. And she always sort of harbored this desire to open a restaurant. But she was a mother. She waited. She had two children, and she waited for them to have left home. And then she said, you know what? I'm going to do this. And she opened a little neighborhood, tiny little eatery. She had a little display case of sort of daily specials. And
is there a Palestinian expat community in Bay Ridge? I mean, I'm thinking Bay Ridge and Bensonhurst is like old school, like Italian.
You know, when she got married, she at a very young age, her husband was working in New York. She flew over. And he was in Bay Ridge, and she was like, okay, this is great. And they built their community around them.
Yeah.
And very quickly, this tiny little restaurant was outgrowing itself. The line was around the block, and they moved to a larger space. And wherever you have great food, people will come. I think that's just the essence of it.
Yeah, it's one of the things about New York, for the most part. It's true. We're a super, super passionate food town. I mean, we could go on and on with the names, and we're not giving basically by the book, first of all. Women Chefs of New York. The recipes are great. The photographies are great. I love the narrative stories. You know, another one of my favorites is Missy Robbins. Missy's cool. Missy was born and raised in Connecticut, Jewish girl from suburbs. I didn't realize she was in New York, had ever worked in New York, but her sort of coming out party was getting the job at Avoce after Andrew Carmellini left, and that was like huge shoes to fill. And I remember I was doing radio at WR then, and I'm like, Missy who? You know, I don't know what you stepped into, but Andrew, people love that guy, and that's his restaurant. You know, after he was with Danielle for years again, and I remember like finally a publicist talked me into going there one day for lunch, and I'm like, whatever, you know, I guess I'm free, I'll do it. And I'm like blown away. She's like such a badass.
She's a tough cookie.
So she was running both Avoce, Columbus, yes. Circle. And lived in your neighborhood, lived in the West Village. Well, you'd never see her there because she works 6 days a week, 40 hours.
You know, when we met for this book, she had already left Avoce. She's now opening a new place, Lilia.
Yep. Any day.
And it was funny because she really needed time off. She had worked herself to the bone. Yeah. She sort of physically, she needed to restore herself mentally. And we met at Bouvette. Actually, we had breakfast at Bouvette. And she was very excited about what was coming next. And I think Lilia is going to open soon, I believe. And the one thing that struck me about Missy, and you struck the nail on the head, is that, and this is common amongst all these women in the book, is their drive.
Oh, it's not totally. Trust me. It's a guy that's in this business. It's not for half steppers.
Right.
Period. Genders, non gender specific. No one does well in this business unless you put your shoulder and you push hard, show up early, stay late, and just don't complain.
And the one thing that these women all said to me was that when they got into the kitchen, they put their gender aside.
Yeah.
They said for the most part, they never encountered any prejudice. I'm sure there was the odd misogynistic chef here and there. But, you know, they just put their heads down and they knuckled down like everyone else.
Yep.
And they made it.
And in a way, I'll tell you this, knowing like Gabrielle Hamilton real well, that in a way you almost had to be badder than the guys. You had to be a badass.
Yes.
Really, that was kind of what you had to do. It wasn't just enough to be as good. You had to be better.
Yes.
To hold your own. It's a great book. We're out of time. Thanks so much, Sinatra, for coming in. It's great. So the book is Women Chefs of New York City. The recipe's great. We didn't talk about the recipes because honestly, I don't usually do that on this show anyway. I kind of prefer the broader strokes of the topic at hand. This book is so worth it for the recipes because the chefs that submitted them are great. You vetted the recipes. But I think what I love, again, the most is the narrative stories, sort of the up-close personal of all of these ethnicities, all of these women's various convergent stories of how they came to this business from out of the country, from within the country, from all sorts of socioeconomic strata, colors, creeds. It's great. Thanks for writing it. Keep up the great work and enjoy the West Village.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
All right, folks, next week, I don't know who my guests are next week. We've got another busy show. I think I've got three guests again, so stay tuned for that. We'll be back. Be well. Eat well often. See you in a week.
Listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.